All right, we're going to begin. This is the Dante Bosco Q&A with assistance.
Hey.
So, are you guys going to ask if the scar is on the wrong side?
No.
No, you're not. Good job. Yes, that was the first test. So, I hear that you're making a movie. The Rufio prequel?
Actually, we did make a short film on my YouTube channel, which is pretty funny because I didn't create the movie. A young film director named Jonah Feingold approached me at a bar in L.A.
That's great.
Yeah, and then
where all the good things get done.
I know. It's actually a popular bar in L.A. called Delilah, and it's like a watering hole, like a little Hollywood spot. Anyway, I was walking to my table, and this kid taps me on the shoulder. Not kid. I mean, he's an SC grad.
Kids.
Probably like 25 or something like that at the time. And he's tapping me on the shoulder. He's like, hey, man, I got to talk to you. Like, what's up, man? I was like, on my way to the table. And he's like, no, he shows me his phone, right? And his phone has the poster of Hook on it. I was like, oh, cool, man. Bang, right? He goes, no, I need to talk to you. And then I said, well, I'm going to my table. And then he goes, I'll go to your table. And he comes to my table. We go to the bar. We have a few shots of tequila. Definitely was tequila.
How all the good ideas get going.
Yeah. And I think two shots in, he's like, I want to pitch you this idea. And he starts pitching me the origin story of Rufio. And he wants to do this whole thing. And I know his agent, William Morris, that he's working with or whatnot. And then we end up having lunch. And then he ends up saying he wants to kickstart this idea. And so I was like, all right. I talked to my producing partner, and he said, hey, let the kid do it. And so he did it, and we supported him. We produced it with him. But the great thing is, you know, the thing is, we're like, we'll just shoot it on, like, DSLRs and, like, whatever. We'll just shoot it for free. Let's just do something interesting. He's, no, it's going to cost us, like, $25,000. And we're like, yeah, I'm not going to pay for that. I was like, I'm not paying for that. And he goes, we'll kickstart it, right? And so the great thing is we raised the money in like 24 hours.
Wow.
I was like, ooh, okay. And then a lot of other, a lot of like PR, I mean, like a lot of networks and platforms picked up the story. And then we ended up kept raising money. And then people wanted to watch this movie. And then it started raising too much. We kind of had to stop. We had to stop raising money for it because I think we raised like $75,000. And we're like, wow. Hey, we can't. You guys, we don't even own the rights to this movie. Like, we can't. This is like for a YouTube movie. And so we ended up doing it with my company. I work with The Machine, and it's fun. You can see it on my YouTube channel right now, the Dante Bosco channel on YouTube. But good things are happening from it because I just met with Netflix about a Rufio project and with Sony, an animated project with Rufio, and it's partially because of that film. And so. Nothing, you know, can't really talk about the things we're developing right now, but there's a Rufio origin story in the mix.
That's excellent.
In Hollywood.
Yeah. I know, my wife's like, we need to watch Hook right now, and it wasn't on Netflix. She's like, but everything.
Yeah, I know, it was.
It used to be.
Yeah. Who knows how that, we don't know how these Netflix contracts work.
We really don't.
We don't know.
They just cycle in and out.
Yes. Yeah. But before we go on, can everyone introduce themselves so I know everybody on the panel?
Good point. You're rude of us.
So I'm Dwayne Joseph Olson. I'm a voice actor on the animated series Satellite City. I'm a guest here, and I am helping out with this panel today.
Awesome.
I'm Tom Quackenbush, fantasy author and knower of paranormal things. This is Dante Bosco.
I'm Dante Bosco.
I'm not sure if you know him.
Sometimes I'm a prince of the Fire Nation. Sometimes I'm a leader of the Lost Boys. And also, I'm also the Mac Daddy Dragon. Of the NYC, which is close by.
Yeah.
Adam Tilford, I'm a writer, animator, do an animated series off my novel called Shatter Heaven.
Awesome. I'm Ellie Collins. I write, direct, produce, and voice act for the horror serial The Blood Crow Stories.
Very cool.
Did I see that you had another movie about, like, being Filipino or something about the Philippines?
Yeah. I mean, there's a classic film I did called The Debut, but they say, like, The Debut. And it's about a coming-of-age story of Filipino-Americans. We did it, like, 18 years ago. which is really cool because it was the first Filipino-American film in Hollywood that's ever been done. And I was really honored to get to play the character, and it became one of those cult classic films. A lot of, you know, especially like a certain generation of Filipino. Even if you're a Filipino-American today, it's like you probably have it in your library at home, in your DVDs somewhere. But it was really cool because it's like really, it kind of was like some of the early indie films we did. And I think we shot the film for less than 500 grand, like 400 grand or something like that. And it went around the country and it grossed over $2.1 million, which is really cool. For an indie film, it got picked up by Sony Classics. And so, very kind of important film in my resume, in my life.
Anyone else want to ask anything? I will monopolize them.
So
if
people are interested in seeing it, where can they, is it available anywhere?
I don't know where, I'm sure you can get it on Amazon or something like that. You can get almost anything on Amazon.
Yeah.
I'm almost positive. Called The Debut. And with Crazy Rich Asians that came out this year and had such an impact on Hollywood, and people are talking about Asian American filmmaking, a lot of people that know about the genre bring up The Debut because it's one of the first in like Asian American, like true Asian American filmmaking. Came out the same year that Better Luck Tomorrow came out, and to be a part of that whole movement of Asian American films, and we still, to this day, beyond my acting side on camera, I write and produce, and I have a part of a company in Hawaii called Kinetic Films that we do Asian American films, and I'm part of a company called The Machine, and we just opened up offices in Asia, so we're doing a lot of things beyond Asian American filmmaking now. We're calling like New Asian Media, which is really borderless Asian media. I just produced a film out in Manila, and I did a film out in China, mainland China, and it's about really bridging what we're trying to do here in America with all the star systems and money coming out of Asia.
Yeah, the China cinema scene is intense.
Intense.
Yeah.
Yeah, you pretty much have to like almost market to China or put things in for China, which is good.
Yeah, totally. I mean,
the
world.
Living in China, seeing films that we.
You live in China?
Mm-hmm.
What part?
Xiamen.
No idea.
It's down along the coast in the Fujian province.
Very cool.
But yeah, the seeing films that you'd already seen in America and going like, wait a second, it's completely different.
Totally.
Has writing always been something that you've been drawn towards, or did that kind of come along once your acting career really took off?
No, I've been a writer for a long time. I started. For the people that came to my panel last night, I do a lot of poetry. So I started writing poetry a long time ago, years ago. I started a poetry venue in my living room over 20 years ago, like 23 years ago, called DPL. Originally it was called Dante's Poetry Lounge. Today it's DPL, the Poetry Lounge. I brought in four friends of mine, Shihan, Poetry the Poet, and and we became the founders of the Poetry Lounge. And this poetry venue has gone on for over 20 years and still resides in Los Angeles, Fairfax and Melrose, every Tuesday night, 9 to midnight. And it became the inspiration of what became Deaf Poetry Jam on HBO and on Broadway, which won a Tony. And now it's the largest weekly open mic in the world, they say. It's crazy.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So my writing comes from that, right? So I've been writing poetry like most of my life and been a part of the scene and part of like all these really, really fine and great poets. All, you know, especially the American poets have all come through my poetry venue. And so being able to rub elbows with them and see their work and be inspired by their work and then having my own stuff written and published, and then it's just a natural progression to that became writing. Some of these early films we did, I co-wrote a film with Kev Jumba, wrote a film with Asia Raphael, these YouTube stars, and then I wrote a play called Midnight Makeout Session where all the monologues are spoken word pieces, and then I'm writing a film right now for my brothers called The Fabulous Filipino Brothers that we're getting funded out of Asia. And so, it's just a natural progression. I love writing. It's one of those things where I started writing and I took some classes and I'm hanging out and trying to figure out how to write scripts and stuff, and it came pretty easy. And my writing instructors were like, well, you've read like thousands of scripts. You've read more scripts than most writers have read, you know, screenwriters, because I grew up acting. And so there's an innate thing that I kind of understand three-act structure. I understand writing to a degree.
Right.
Who knows if it's any good, but, you know, still I kind of understand what it's supposed to look like at the end of the day.
So then you have a lot of experience with collaboration through that.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about filmmaking is it's a collaborative art.
Right.
You know, it's almost one of the only purely collaborative arts. You can't, you cannot make a film by yourself. You just can't do it.
No.
I mean, you need actors, you need other artists. I mean, when you get to the big level of filmmaking, you have, you know, hopefully really great artists, but you have artists in every category from, of course, the things we know, like acting, you know, the people on the screen, but you have, like, artists that are creating the sets, doing the wardrobe, of course, the directors of photography, the guys moving the lights, painting with the lights around you. There's so many aspects of what's going on. It's such a collaborative art, and it's very unlike anything, you know. Visual artists are really great, but they can really paint a portrait by themselves. Musicians, you know, when you have a band, there's a lot of different artists, but there's producers that can go into the studio and just knock out a song alone. And it's like, that's something we can't do as filmmakers. We really have to figure out how to work with other people.
Kind of forces you to cooperate for those who are a little more stubborn.
Definitely to cooperate. Also, check your ego. You know what I'm saying?
Totally.
And, you have to cooperate, because I've been on sets where cooperation was really good, and I've been on sets where cooperation was really bad, and you can see it all kind of like tumbling down, you know?
You have any stories from things that didn't go as well and how you were able to rise from the ashes? Or?
No, I mean...
Not ratting anybody out.
No, you can't rat anybody out. No, the thing is, you could just tell when... I mean, is there any filmmakers out there? I know there's a film school here, right? Filmmakers, yes.
I do costuming for film television.
Ed Sheeran in the audience. Hey. Basically, there's a lot of times as an actor, I see it go awry, because when you have a director, right, the director is kind of like he's the mediator. You know, people that want to be directors, you're like the mediator. Like, you're the guy that goes between two sides of the camera, right? You're the communicator. You're talking to the actors, all the people on this side of the camera doing their thing. And there's all these guys, whether it be the camera crew and the guys who do the sets and everything on this side of the camera. And, like, director's kind of there talking to both sides and trying to make it both go both ways. And sometimes when it's the worst situation where there's a war between two sides of the camera, right? The amount of time it takes to set up a shot and the art it takes to set the shot up and then the art that's happening within the shot. And so there's a lot of power struggles that go on, like, well, it's going to take 6 hours to set up the shot, and then we're going to shoot it for 15, 20 minutes. Actors don't like that, you know? And vice versa, the actors can be, like, taking way long to act because there's a lot of diva behavior going on, and the people that are setting up the stuff don't have the time to do their stuff. So that's when you find where it really goes awry, and everyone has to step up and try to mediate and try to make it go as good as it can.
And filmmaking requires a lot of trust.
Yeah.
Especially interdepartment trust, because, like, costuming, I have to trust that my extras costumer is going to dress people how we talked about.
Yes.
And when you break down that trust, that's where it falls apart.
Totally. And everyone has to value everyone else's art form.
Yep.
Yeah.
Now, when you describe, like, being in that immersive environment of collaboration in a film, how does that compare in your experience to voice acting, where you're, you know, in a booth by yourself getting orders from somebody behind glass?
Right. At first, it was very strange, because it is different. You know, there's no one playing with your clothes, and there's no makeup lady, like, putting makeup on your face, and I love all those relationships. I mean, the part of the lifestyle of the set is not just doing the work and seeing the work at the end, but it's also the lifestyle of, like, living with other artists and hanging out in the community of what that filmmaking is. The community changes when you do voice acting, because, you know, you're so far away from the artist, that a visual artist, right? The visual artist could be in Korea.
Yeah, the side of the world, yeah.
Yeah. But they're shooting you, and they're, like, a lot of times early in it, they're, like, filming our faces and they're filming our mannerisms, so it can inspire some of the artists to kind of do what they're going to do. And you do work with the creative teams that are, like in the case of Avatar: The Last Airbender, like, Mike and Brian are there every day, right? And they're in the booth listening to all the takes, and we're going back and forth, and we're talking about the characters, and we're talking about everything, the martial arts that they're doing, the style, the story, and they, you know, they're really good friends of mine over the years that we've worked together. So it changes because you don't have a lot of that stuff, but you still have the community of the room. Like all of a sudden, you're the people you kind of are relying on to build your performance and to build the world for you as an artist is the guys in the room, which usually is like me, Jack DeSena, who played Sokka, Mae Whitman, who played Katara, you know, Mako, who played Uncle Iroh. We were there a lot together in the room, and so it's kind of like feeding off their energy and like working with them. And then you have amazing people behind the booth like Mike and Brian that are behind the glass with Andrea Romano, who's a legendary voice director who, I don't know, she's just magical. You know what I'm saying? So you're just looking at them for guidance on kind of your character. And yeah.
Is it kind of like a more, not easier, but do you find that you have more confidence in the booth than you do in front of the camera? Less? How does it compare?
No, for me, it's the same thing. You know, people always ask, like, do you prefer voice acting or film acting, or how does it differ? And of course, there are differences just because there's a, you know, it's different. But as far as acting is concerned, it's the same. We're doing characters and we're trying to, at least for me, it's when I'm acting, you're really just trying to be truthful. What you're trying to do as an actor is you're trying to uncover some truth. And I'm doing the same performance, whether there's a camera in the room or just a microphone. I mean, that's me because I come from on camera. I mean, I've been very fortunate to work with a lot of voice actors that are doing crazy things, right? I mean, I'm usually coming in, if you hear my voice work, I'm pretty much playing myself as a fire prince or a teenage dragon guy, right? And that's the kind of, you know, as an actor, that's, I mean, I know what I'm doing, but I'm in the room with these guys are like Kevin Michael Richardson or D. Bradley Baker or Grady Lyle, and I'm playing one character and they're playing like, you know, six characters each, and you're just sitting there and you're watching them do these amazing performances, talking to themselves and doing trolls and fairies and other things, and I'm just like, can I try that? They're like, nah, it sounds like Dante.
So I'm glad you brought that up, because that was kind of my next question. You know, two of you know, your most iconic roles being Rufio and Prince Zuko, you know, they're two very angsty young men who are clearly you know, holding a lot on their hearts. What do you feel is the most similar about the two characters, and what do you think separates them the most?
They're very similar, you know, definitely. You know, as far as what separates them is, I don't know. I mean, it was a lot of years that came between the two characters, but, you know, I talked about it last night. I mean, there's artists here, there's creative people here. A lot of people that are in school to be creative, and we talked about it last night in my panel last night. As an artist, we do a lot of stuff, right? And within your art form, you do a lot of different things, and then even outside of your art form, you do a lot of things, and you should develop a lot of these different skills. And as my career has gone, I've gone beyond acting to poetry, to writing, screenwriting, playwriting, to producing. I'm going to be directing this year, and so there's all this stuff that kind of goes on. But what I was saying last night in the panel is, as artists, although ultimately you're going to be able to do a lot of things, hopefully, and you can do a lot of things, you're actually going to get famous doing one thing, right? That's what a lot of people don't realize. Like, you're actually going to get famous doing one thing, and it's going to be nice, or it's going to be easier as an artist if you can figure out what that's going to be for you. Because not that fame is like, okay, part of everything that we, especially as young artists, you know, getting into the game of entertainment or anything that we, you know, it doesn't have to be entertainment, anything that we want to pursue in life, you know, there's a degree of fame and fortune and, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. We talked about that last night. I mean, there's a degree of that goes on. But I talk about the fame aspect only because fame in itself will open doors for all the other things in life that you're gonna want to do. And so, I only bring that up now because you asked about those two characters. It's like that character, not even only those two characters, but if you look at my whole career, the degree of that character that keeps coming back up, mm-hmm. like that is my casting. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. The casting is like, this is a kid or a guy that we think's gonna be bad, and probably is a little bad, but then there's some enlightenment, and then he actually turns good at the yeah. end. Like that is the character of my life. Like, you know what I'm saying? That's me. But if you look at a lot of characters, I was talking like about Han Solo last night and Indiana Jones. It's like the same character. Like these, when you look at movie stars, they actually play the same characters over and over again, because that's how the world sees, that's how we see them. And as young artists, there's a way that you see yourself, and that's great, and that's you should see yourself the way you want to see yourself, but then also you need to take a time to see how the world sees you, because if you can understand how the world sees you and how the world's going to buy your art, then you're going to be able to scale that art easier. You're going to have less angst and problems in your life going, but I'm James Dean. Like, what, you're James Dean to yourself, but you may be
Steve Buscemi to everyone else.
And that's cool. Then, like, let me sell Steve Buscemi, but also be James Dean in my heart.
Yin and yang, really.
Yeah, yin and yang. So, I mean, that's one of the biggest things I think for young artists coming into any part of the industry to really understand is to start, if you really want to get in the business, the business of the business is to see what you're selling. Like, not even what you're selling, what they're buying from you. And be honest about that, and then you could start. The reality is, once you sell that, if you get famous enough doing that, you're going to be able to do other things.
It's kind of like be aware of the weapon that you wield.
Yes.
And then that way you can use it to your advantage.
Yes.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
So what has been your favorite role? Is it one of the better ones?
I mean, my favorite role, it's hard to say favorite roles, right?
Yeah.
Because it's like, so I've been an actor, you guys, for people that don't know my career, I've been an actor for a long time. I said this last night, I've been an actor longer than everybody in the room's been alive, and I think it's also maybe today. No, mostly. I don't know, not everyone. I see someone who, named not yet here. So I've been an actor for 34 years, and so that's a long time. And so over that time, you go, well, you know, what's your favorite role? The thing is, it's like for us as filmmakers, you know, you look back on your roles and they're great. I mean, doing Hook is great. Being Rufio was really great. I was 15 years old and I got to work with Spielberg and Dustin Hoffman and Robin Williams. And I mean, doing Avatar I did for like 10 years, you know, a decade. And the thing is, there's tons of films and TV shows that, you know, you guys may not have known, may not have seen, from The Wonder Years to like Moesha to like, whatever, like things in your life. And when I look back at my resume, my career, it's like it's your life. So it's like, what's your favorite part of your life? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So when I look back at movies, and it's, you don't really experience it as an audience member. You really experience it as the artist that went through it. And so it's more of a picture book of your life. And so I go, well, what's your favorite part of your life? It's hard to say. Mm-hmm. They all mean so much different things to me. But as far as characters, Rufio changed my life, for sure. My life got changed again doing Zuko, for sure. I mean, even doing the Dabu, being able to do that project for the Asian American community, and really what's that impacted has been really important to me. So, you know, those are some of the important ones.
Yeah, because I was going to say, like, have you had like roles that have meant something to you as an individual, like maybe your culture or your background,
yeah.
that you could take those opportunities you've gotten to maybe help showcase to other people?
Totally. There's a movie I did that's kind of like a lesser known movie overall, but it's very known within certain areas. This film I did called Fake in the Funk. Right, mm-hmm. So this film called Faking the Funk. And the thing about it is, that movie starred myself and Margaret Cho and who else is in it? God, what do you call it, that my mom, who played Jackie Brown? You know Jackie Brown?
Oh, I don't remember.
Tip of my tongue.
Yeah, it's like, you know,
she played my mother. So basically, this film was called Faking the Funk. We did this in the 90s, and it's about this Asian kid from Atlanta who got adopted by a black family, and he was raised in the hood, right? And so, and it's called Faking the Funk, and people think he's faking the funk, but then they realize, oh, you're actually not faking the funk. You're actually, you know, adopted by a black family. Like, it's like, it's a really weird kind of film, but it's a hood classic film. And I grew up in the neighborhoods in L.A. outside of Compton, a little town called Paramount. And so that movie's kind of important to me because, you know, it was like a lot of, like, now, you know, the Asian thing's coming up, and there's all these young artists that come to me, especially within, like, the hip-hop area of, like, Asian. And they're like, you were the first hip-hop. First of all, you're like, you're the first cool Asian I've ever saw. But I'm a big voice for Asians in Hollywood, like Asian American filmmaking, right? And people go like, why are you doing this? I started a company like 8 years ago, and we're doing Asian American Pacific Islander films, right? And I'm like creating these vehicles for like young YouTube stars and Asian leads. And then my friends in the industry that are white were going like, why are you doing this? Like, just put a white lead in there and we can get like this money to do this or this and that. And I go, what is this? That's the thing. It's like you're not really understanding what we're trying to do. Because what happens is I know my career, right? And I know what I've done. And I've gone around, I spoke at colleges and art schools, and I meet young artists all the time. And for a certain generation of young artists, even now the ones coming up today, the Asian actors will come up to me and will go, well, yeah, you're like the first cool Asian I ever saw on movie and television, like ever, right? Even John Chow, who directed and produced Crazy Rich Asians, they ask him, like, this whole film's about Asian representation. Like, what was your first time feeling represented in Hollywood? He's like, Rufio. In the movie Hook, like, Dante Bosco's Rufio. In the movie Hook, and they go. But beyond that, it's like, even beyond just the artistry, you know, I was talking, kids coming to me, adults coming to me all the time, and they're like, well, you know, like, a girl's like, Well, a guy, like, interracial couple come to me and go, hey, man, like, an Asian guy, be like, you know, my wife, like, yeah, he goes, you know, growing up, she had a big crush on you. I was like, oh, yeah? He goes, yeah, so I know for sure you're, like, one of the reasons why she married me. For sure. And I'm like, okay. I mean, you're welcome. And things like Faking the Funk, I brought up Faking because it really started to open up for a different genre of, like, what Asians are in America. There's a very thin stereotype of what Asians could be in Hollywood and in film. And when I came along, I was just someone who opened up a different idea of what, of course, I mean, as humans, and we know that we're everything. But the thing about Hollywood is, the reality of what Hollywood is every character that I've played in my career, not every, like 99%, you know? And of every Asian character that's been ever seen in Hollywood, like 99% is from the perspective and written directly by the perspective of a white man. I mean, it's not saying it's false. I'm saying that's his experience of Asians in America, right? And so I go, well, we have to create more product, and we, Asian Americans, African Americans, Latino Americans, women, you know what I'm saying? In general, have to create more projects and product because we have to tell them our experience from our own point of view. Because no one's gonna know us like us, like ourselves. And consequently, there's gonna be characters of white males in our story from our perspective. And that's how art, that's the conversation of art, is us telling stories from our perspective, and that we go back and forth. The problem that we all have is that it's been so much in the hands of like one particular group, mostly white males. And it's not like their fault, it's just that's where it's been. And so as we go into this new era of media, it just has to be more balanced. Like, these other stories have to be told, and has to be told authentically through our own experiences as all the different marginal groups in the world, you know what I'm saying, or whatever, different ethnic groups, or how we're doing it. So that's where we are, and that's why I'm a part of the movement, and that's what we talk about, and that's why certain roles are more important to me, because it's been able to open the scope of who we are, you know, the human experience.
Yeah. Cause no, that's great. It's like I'm mixed.
Yeah.
I'm Puerto Rican and you know white. So it's like I didn't under like growing up, it's like I didn't see a lot of you know Latinos were presented a certain specific way, and not a lot of opportunities for them.
Right.
And so like it didn't really occur to me that much.
Right.
But like writing and trying to like okay, I have a perspective, mm-hmm. and I would like to show it. So it's like hearing your writing, like how much of your writing and the stuff that you're trying to, I mean, you've answered 90% of the questions I was going to follow up and ask. but just like a lot of you're putting a lot of your writing, and that's to help bring your stories and your perspective and experiences forward. There was a webcomic, I think.
Yeah.
That you were trying to, or
we're doing, yeah. I just closed a deal with a company called Tapas, which is a dope webcomic app. And they have a project on there called Kids Being Kids that we're co-producing. It's about like teenagers in the Philippines. And so, I mean, I'm pretty new to producing. I mean, not pretty new, extremely new to producing animation. So I signed on to do it. So we'll see. I actually called up Mike and Brian from Avatar. I was like, hey, yo, I'm doing this thing. I need some advice. So it's good to have guys like that you can kind of call on.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
But, I mean, it's a panel. Can I do a poem?
You want a poem, right? It's going to stop you.
I was fun doing poems just because in the middle of my panels and talks, just because I don't know, I like poems. But it goes with like this thing about perspective that we're talking about. Here's a poem. It goes like this. Where are you from? Well, that's a loaded question. See, I grew up in a blue-collar town, simply meaning the blacks and the browns, and me being of that category. Plus, my pops made less than 40. Jeez, yeah, it's clear to see that me, I be, well, blue-collar. Better yet, broke most of the time. Even better, poor. But when you're young and you're poor, you don't know that you're poor. It never occurs to you that you don't have a bed. Everyone sleeps on the floor. 18 in a house, one bathroom, someone always knocking on the door. At least it was fun. Let's get back to where we started. Where are you from? See, where I'm from, there are cops and there are gangsters, also known as gangbangers, not unlike the cops and robbers of the movies. But unlike the movies, it's not so black and white. There are areas of gray, and that is to say, it's hard to distinguish the difference between being pulled over by a cop and being hit up by a gangster. Both evoke a bit of pain in the pit of your stomach. I think it's anger masked by shame. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Let me explain. Followed by a cop. Follow six blocks, pulled over by the cop, he pulls you over, he looks at you as if you are a mark. Where are you from? He does not wait for you to reply, instead he accuses you as you deny. You're from the east side, I know sir, bow your head, don't look him in the eyes. It's embarrassing sitting on the curb watching the cars drive by, but being where I'm from, that's just another part of my life. Now when it comes to the gangbanger, all you got to be is a stranger. When he asks you, where are you from, you can feel it laced with danger. So watch what you say next, because you're playing with death. So don't claim the East, don't claim the West. Matter of fact, same rules apply. Bow your head, don't look him in the eyes. I ain't from nowhere, man. I'm just some guy. See, he too sees you as a mark. But they don't really see you, your face, or your heart. All they see are marks. Now, me being me, I got a few tricks up my sleeves. Messed up situations, I've gotten out of a few of those by simply picking my nose. That's right, picking my nose, check it. When the cop pulls up, I can feel the heat in his eyes, or a Monte Carlo filled with gangsters pulls up next to my side. I pretend I don't see them, and I casually try to pick a booger from my nose. And for a second, just a moment, I'm exposed. To be a man, not a mark, a human being just like you. Don't lie, you got boogers too. And the cops, he just continues to roll down the street, and the gangsters, where they just laugh and then they just leave. Sometimes when you see a little bit of yourself in someone else, it could set you free. And the funny thing is, I'm probably from where they're from. The other side of town, I'm just trying to get home. Quick poetry break.
Yeah. Question do we follow up with?
Yeah. So when they do the biopic of you, do you want to be played by Emma Stone or Scarlett Johansson?
Yeah, that's actually, yeah. I don't know. I like them both a a lot. I actually have a book deal right now. It's this, and I didn't want to write a book. You know what I'm saying? I didn't have a thought to write a book, but this company came up to me. This publishing house called Not a Cult Indie, really cool indie publishing press, and they approached me to write a book. And I was like, about what? Like, I've had like poetry books published, and I was like, want me to do another poetry book? They're like, you can have some poetry in there, but we really want your perspective on life in Hollywood, because you're one of the only actors, Asian actors, that we know of, especially this generation, that has been here for over, you know, you grew up in Hollywood. Like, we've seen you grow up in Hollywood, and what was that like for an Asian American? And so I'm writing that book right now. It's called From Rufio to Zuko. So it's really stressful because everybody sent me the cover art and everything. And I'm like, oh, it's not done. But when that book comes out, you know, we can send it to Emma Stone. Maybe, you know, she played Asian one time before, right?
Yeah. She apologized.
No, she did.
Scarlett Johansson did not apologize.
Yeah.
It's not their fault. So, you know, that's part of the problem of Hollywood, is it's a business.
Yes.
You know, and so we just have to you know, change the business.
The casting director is unfortunately the unseen face, so people don't know who to blame.
Yeah, I mean, it's not even the casting's fault. It's the studio's fault.
Oh yeah.
Because it all comes down to money, and it all comes down to the statistics on when you're putting budgets in the film. As I'm producing, I start to get those kind of like, I understand, because we're putting budgets together. We know whoever we put in the film can get more money due to all these like numbers, and so we just have to get Asian faces that have higher numbers so we can get more money.
Well, hopefully Crazy Rich Asians is
helping. Yeah, it's helping. Yeah. It's all moving.
Oh, do we want to open to...
Sure.
Yeah, questions.
So, who has a question?
Izzy.
Hi.
What's up?
Chilling.
How are you doing?
Great. I actually wrote down the question, so I'm not stumbling over my words.
Okay.
So let me get you. You kind of answered this question, but I think we can maybe extrapolate on it a little bit. Because you've done so many roles within the TV and movie making industry, do you have a preference for acting or writing or any of the other things that you've done? Or does it really depend on the project that you're working on?
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, people, you know, you ask a question like that, like, do you like to do this or that? The really, when it comes down to it, it's the same thing. Like, for us, you know, like I said, there's a lot of artists here, right? So, we just want to express ourselves and we want to tell stories. I mean, at the end of the day, all we're doing, doesn't matter if you're doing film, television, stage, even if you're painting a picture or taking photographs, you're telling a story. We're storytellers, and we're trying to tell these stories, and ultimately you want to tell stories and for those stories to have impact. I mean, the first hurdle is like having the courage to tell the story, right? And then the second hurdle is, can that story will it matter to anybody? Can it get out to anybody? We're living in an amazing time where things change. Like the ability to impact is wild. I mean, there are some YouTube videos that are more impactful than Hollywood movies. I mean, it's $100 million Hollywood movie that no one cares about, and some kid did some 2-minute video that went viral and got seen by 50 million people. I mean, like, we're all talking about that. And so there's a great, you know, just even ground for artists are out there right now. At the end of the day, you want to tell a good story. You want to tell a good story. And it could be a picture. It could be a meme. I mean, literally, it's a joke, but yeah. Like, sometimes you're like, dude, they're geniuses. Some people are geniuses that can create things like that. And so keep fine-tuning what you want to do. But it's really, a good story is going to be, you know, Netflix changed again. I mean, Stranger Things was more impactful than anything that year in Hollywood, film, television, and that's a you know, a streaming service. I mean, the world's changing. I mean, Roma might win the Oscar this year for best film of the year. It's a Netflix movie. You know, like, that, like, it changes. We don't have to worry about mediums anymore. Like, let's worry less about mediums and more about good storytelling. Because if you have a good story and you get it out there, people are going to find it. This is, that's the world we're living in now.
Are you involved with the Netflix Avatar reboot?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No. No,
we should leave it at that.
No, I mean, I am going to be involved in it. Okay. Yes. Yes. I just met with Mike and Brian, and I love those guys, and we all know that there's a Netflix reboot going on, and I can't talk a lot about it, but yeah, I'm going to be involved in it. You know, definitely in the consulting role, and you know, and I'm sure I'll wind up in it somewhere.
Good.
But you know, awesome. I'm consulting. So vague, but yes.
Yeah. That's probably as much as you can go.
Yeah, as much as
you can go. Look at that, won't we?
Right. So, any other questions? I don't see your name, so purple.
What do you think the most important thing is for telling a story? Like, what's the most important elements for telling a story that really can grip a large audience and can be relatable and universal?
Did you guys hear a question? Like, what's the thing that's most important in telling stories? In any art, in telling stories, there's you know, my philosophy is my philosophy. It's truth. This is the thing. Like, we write fiction. You know what I'm saying? Like, obviously, all these things aren't real. But, and when we act, obviously, it's not real. You know what I'm saying? We're pretending to be whatever, things that we're not. But what echoes is truth. Like, if you uncover truth in a story, in a performance, that's the glue that sticks everything together. That's the thing that resonates in other people. And it's these truth, it's like you gotta find truth. If you found truth and you're able to, you know, distill it and disseminate this piece of truth, that's what rings true to people. People also understand fake. Like, fakeness also turns people off. Like, they don't even know why they don't like it, or it just doesn't feel right to them, because it's not true. And when there's truth there, that's kind of what attracts people, I think, to really great projects. And not that they're doing, like, not that we're all here to do nonfiction work, it's just that we've uncovered some kind of truth about the human experience, or like really, or something truthful is in there, and that's really what is resonating, echoing, and how people are kind of receiving it. At a high level, when I'm teaching acting or talking to like really master class of actors, and we're talking about, you're doing all this character work and you're doing all these things and you're doing the script, and it's a stacked deck, right? Because it's like, we actually know what we're gonna say. We actually know how the movie's gonna end. Every actor going into the story knows how it's gonna friggin' end. But if you can somehow in the script find moments to be really real, like to be truthful, like not the character respond. If this girl says something to you and like breaks your heart, like don't get broken heart as a character, like really receive it and have a real true moment on screen like that. These little pieces of truth can really glue together your whole performance and be able, you can do all kinds of crazy stuff if it's like somehow has this resonation of truth in it. So I mean, I'm walking all around the question, but ultimately as a storyteller, if you can find truth, you're gonna be in good hands. I mean, it's you could say it easier than, sometimes hard to find, because sometimes you'll be knee deep in some project, you're like, this is a bunch of bullshit. All this is crap, I don't even know what I'm doing.
And then like someone else will tell you like, oh, it meant this. You're like, that's exactly what I meant to do.
They may not know what it means to you, but there's times where you're like, you can do something and there's these things that mean, you know, when you're writing, it's like, this is what it means to me, but it doesn't have to mean it to the same thing to them.
No, right.
Because it's their truth, but at least it resonated your truth also meant something.
I call those black and white cookie moments.
Okay.
Because I was in a writing class once and somebody said to another actor another writer afterwards, yeah, I love how the black and white cookie in your script was meant to symbolize the Civil War. And he's like, yes.
That is.
Great. That is what that meant. I'm glad that you noticed.
More questions?
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Kayla.
Hi, Kayla.
A little bit of a basic question, but of course, what is your favorite Zuko line, if you can pick? Or at least, like, you know, a couple of your most memorable.
What's yours?
Well, okay, I'm basic again, but like, that's where funny is all.
Great. Well, I did these poems last night. There's a lot of, I can do poems. Should I do the poems again? Oh, this will be
yeah,
more
poems.
We did these like Zuko, like the Avatar. I think these, I wrote these short poems for like Vine back in the day. And so here we go.
Now that's just TikTok.
A poem called Honor for something lost or misplaced, etched into your consciousness like a scar upon your face. This honor that you chase isn't always what you thought. Matter of fact, the fact that you always had is the very reason why you set out to prove its existence from the start. Toph Bay Fung. So small but so strong, she moves mountains. Next time I go on a life-changing adventure, you're invited to come along. And a poem for my friend who doesn't even bend, but his heart's as big as the rest of them, and he always has my back, makes me laugh because he's funny. And when his girlfriend turned into the moon, all I could say was, that's rough, buddy. I do find it fascinating that, you know, these little lines become a part of, like people's vernacular or something like that. It's like,
yeah.
I mean, Avatar.
It's
yeah. Yeah, it's so crazy. Like, that's rough, but he's, like, such a crazy...
Because what do you say to that?
Weird
yeah.
thing?
It's a very real response to it.
Yeah. And there's all these other little pieces. I mean, Hook, too. There's, like, so many, like, I meet people that, like, they say lines. Like, had nothing to do with the movie. Hook just becomes things that they say in their life. And it's kind of cool. I mean, it's great as writers that
yeah.
if you can kind of create these things that just catches on. It's amazing.
There's a rap collective that I got turned on to because they have a song called Bangarang.
Oh, dope.
Yeah, they're from Minnesota, Doomtree.
Very cool. Very cool. It's always weird to, you know, when you're a part, like when you, you know, a lot of people, we're artists here, right? We're creatives and we want to go into Hollywood or wherever and make film or whatever you want to make. And hopefully it, you get remembered for something, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Or you can infiltrate pop culture, and it's weird when it happens, right? So it's happened to me a few times now in my career, right? Mm-hmm. And it's, people go like, how does that feel? What's that like? And it is a weird feeling. I wrote a blog one time, I was like, you know you're officially part of pop culture when someone tattoos you on their body that you don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's like, you know, people are always, so Halloween people was like dressing up as Rufio or Zuko, and I get these pictures. And then throughout the year, people would like semi-pick like tattoos of like, I mean, Zuko's very cool, but then also like my actual 15-year-old face. On your thigh or leg or body part, you know, just like Instagram posts, and you're just like, wow.
Is that the weirdest fan reaction, or does it get stranger than that?
No, that's pretty strange. I mean, and then I've met some people in life, and then I've signed the tattoo, and then they got
mm-hmm.
that tatted. It's cool. It's definitely weird to kind of be, you know, kind of in a, like the thing, same thing, like people in Minnesota, like you're part, like not me personally, but something that you've done is a
mm-hmm.
part of like some
yeah.
part of their psyche that means something to them that who knows how you kind of got interwoven in there, but
mm-hmm.
somehow we are able to do art that kind of is in part of that pop culture. I don't 100% understand it either. All I know is people have been nice to me throughout my life, so that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, so tattoos of my 15-year-old face. I'll just do
that's
a
weird.
Collection of those.
And then one day you'll meet a child named Rufio and be like, oh,
I met one.
Oh, okay.
Oh wow.
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 Threw you a curveball.
Yeah.
Which is cool, too. Which is also cool. Who the heck knows? It's a long career. It's crazy stuff happens.
Wow.
Yeah.
There's someone there.
Oh, okay.
Someone.
Please.
Hi. You talked earlier about how you've often had roles of someone who was bad and then became good. So
yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about the arc of Zuko?
Yeah.
And just like how you reacted to the change, or like how much you knew about the change, or like
Yeah, I knew nothing of the change. Like, at first, when I first signed on to do the character, I was actually in the middle of doing Jake Long, American Dragon, and then I went to Nickelodeon to kind of figure out this avatar thing. And to me, it was, I thought I was going to be a bad guy, you know, because when I first went in there, you go to Nickelodeon. First of all, the whole thing was ridiculous. I mean, it's a big lesson in life. Like don't know too much because, like, nobody knows anything, right? Nickelodeon is not known for doing anime or, like, walking into Nickelodeon for this Avatar project, and I've done a few projects with Nickelodeon, but, you know, it's really kind of more kind of, you walk into the gates of Nickelodeon, and it's like this building, Double Dare slime on it, and, you know, there's, like, I was saying last night, there's, like, these big pictures of, these murals of, like, SpongeBob. Like, SpongeBob is a god. He is. I mean, he's made the company, like, $1 trillion. And, like, things like CatDog and, like, crazy, like, Nickelodeon things. Like, super way out, funny, awesome, brilliant, colorful things. And then they give you a script that's obviously
not that.
You know, yeah. Anime-inspired, epic tale of four elements and, like, you know, and I got this weird, you know, this is early Zuko, like, ponytail, ball-headed. Just ball-headed Zuko. You're like, who is this? Scar on the face. He's just angry. And I'm just, like, in my mind, like, this is never going to go. Because the thing is, when you're working Hollywood, we do these things called pilots. You just do the first episode. And we do a bunch of first episodes of things, and they just never go. Or you do, like, a short of, especially animation, they just do, like, these shorts, like, 15, 20-minute shorts. And then, you know, you can kind of get a feel after a while, like, oh, that was cool art and cool story, but no one's, like, Nickelodeon is not going to do an anime friggin', they're not going to do it. This is ridiculous. And so I was like, this is never going to work. And then, obviously, I'm wrong. But then I thought I was, like, just going to be this bad guy running around, yelling, angsty. He was just mad all the time. And I was like, oh, cool. I'll just be, like, a hero on Disney, on the Disney Channel, and I'll be a villain on Nickelodeon. But then it's, you know, then the character starts changing, and it just became this really amazing, amazing character. I mean, after I found out the Scar was going on, that really opened up my eyes and a lot of the cast's eyes, and we just started getting really enthralled in just what was coming, like, what's happening. Is he good? Is he bad? Is, like, flipping back and forth to Zula. It's, like, one of my favorite characters in the script, and got to work with Great Alao through all those seasons, and to see Zuko's kind of, like, you know, his struggle is really, it's really cool to see it over a long period of time, because we did that over, I guess, the books are, like, there's three books, but it's kind of equivalent to four or five seasons of TV, and you get to really see what he was doing. He really surprised the hell out of me. I really had no clue. I had no clue what was going on.
In a way, I mean, maybe you'll agree, maybe you won't, but it was probably better that way, because, I mean, it's funny, but it's true. He didn't know that he was going to become a hero either.
Right, me neither.
Yeah, so you're both in the same spot.
I like to think that, you know, we're all going to become heroes and we just don't know it yet.
That's a good one to look at.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
Or we could be evil villains.
This would be my tattoo.
Yeah.
His face right now with that written over it.
Yeah. With the scarf.
With the scarf. With the scarf. Yes.
Hi, Meg.
Hey, nice to meet you.
So one of my favorite movies that you've been in is Blood and Bones.
Blood and Bones, cool movie, yeah.
I was wondering how you came around to getting a part for that. Like, did somebody come up to you and ask?
Yeah. No, I auditioned for that role, Mike Jai White. Blood and Bone is this movie that people haven't seen. It's like a martial arts film with a guy named Michael Jai White. And the cool thing about that particular film is during, I don't know, it was like maybe 8 years ago now or something like that. And so during that time, it was kind of a actual, kind of like a clap back on for like a lot of the martial artists and MMA fighters. There's a lot of MMA fighters in the movie. And they were just kind of it was like a reaction to all the wire work that, like, the great Hong Kong guys came and did all this stuff from Matrix to now and all these wire work martial arts and these crazy stuff. But they're like, let's just do an old school film, no wire work, no camera tricks, like just fighters fighting and the speed of real fighters, like bare knuckle brawl, right? And so they create this movie called Blood and Bone, and Michael Jai White is the star of it, and I play his manager, a guy named Pinball. I love that movie just because I play this, I don't even know, just like a street guy, a street dude, and I really got to tap into my growing up in the neighborhood, hood days, like Hood Dante. That's like real Hood Dante. I'm talking all kinds of trash. I'm swearing a lot. I'm using the N-word a lot. I'm smoking weed, driving a lowrider. Yeah. It's actually a fun character. So that, to me, that's like one of those fun characters where I kind of got to go back and like be like, if I never left the hood, this is how I'd be living. So it's like one of those kind of fun characters. But I just, you know, in Hollywood, like we're always auditioning for projects, and or sometimes you're getting offered stuff. Sometimes you go and meet producers and you audition for things. And, you know, but that became a classic for sure within that genre. And I just ran to Mike Jai White. We're talking about, I was asking about, what do you think about doing the sequel? And he's like, yeah, we're talking about it. So we'll see.
Seth?
Hi, I'm Seth.
Hi, how are you?
Doing all right. So I think it's really cool that we about poetry and stuff.
Oh, cool.
What's your favorite form of poetry? I've been interested in sonnets for a while.
Yeah.
And then I got into like
slam
poetry
now. Yeah.
What's your favorite?
Well, I love, what got me into poetry, I read poetry growing up, right? So, little stuff, I mean, like I grew up on Dr. Seuss. I love Dr. Seuss. It was amazing. And then when I got in high school, taking poetry and English and whatnot, and I, you know, I dug the sonnets and, you know, you dig Shakespeare and, you know, whoever, Byron, all those dudes you gotta kind of learn for English class, but it seems so far away from me as a teenager growing up, like in the, you know, in the neighborhoods outside of LA. The poet that actually really got me into writing poetry, surprisingly enough, is a poet named Charles Bukowski. And Charles Bukowski is like kind of like the end of the beat poets in the West Coast. And he was this really amazing poet. He's passed away now. But he's a blank verse kind of writer. But he grew up and he writes a lot of poems around L.A., San Pedro, which is like not far from where I grew up in Paramount. And we'd actually go to San Pedro sometimes. And what really kind of resonated in me was like the world he saw was a world I also, similar to my neighborhood, right? But I didn't know that was poetry until like I was reading Bukowski. Like, because, you know, when you're reading Shakespeare and things that are written so far away from you years ago, you're not really understanding, like, how does that, like, that, what is that about my life? Later on in life, you can really draw the lines later on, right? But when I'm, like, 13, 14 years old, and I'm like, that doesn't mean anything to me. When I started reading Charles Bukowski, and he's talking about seeing the girl on the bus stop that's, like, still drunk from last night, and the bottle by her ankle and the slip of her dress still falling, and I'm like, you know, I've seen that girl, that's poetry. Like, then I started seeing the poetry in my life, and that really kind of sparked me to start writing about what I saw around me and what that meant and how that can be artful. And but when I write, you know, you can hear like there's a lot of rhymes in my work because I grew up in the hip-hop generation, so I kind of like, that's how my mind kind of works. And so a lot of my stuff will go on rhyme, slant rhyme, on and off rhyme, but it uses that kind of cadence. And then being a part of the scene in the 90s that when slam poetry kind of got created and spoken word, and me and my crew got written up in the LA Times as the crew that brought poetry back to LA, which is like, you know, I don't know if that's necessarily true. It's like a media thing. There's a lot of other people in LA that get mad about that. I'm like, I didn't write that article. but I always say, regardless if we brought it back, we were a part of the generation that ushered poetry back into the LA art scene and hadn't been that vibrant since like the beat poetry days, where poets in LA and San Francisco would be going back and forth. And so, yeah, man, Charles Bukowski, for sure.
Next question, right there.
Did you come up with a good question?
Well, first, I would like to thank you so much for all your hard work and like contributions to society. Because, like, you may be insignificant because I'm like random ass student in a weird ass basement. But
I'll take it. Very well lit. Well lit, man, in the basement.
The representation I saw when I grew up meant a lot to me.
How cool.
But my question is, you mentioned that people like become famous for one specific thing. And I'm sure there's tons of like positive things to like having a brand.
Yeah.
But do you ever feel limited because you're known as like a fancy bad boy or like...
Yeah, I mean, you know, you gotta take the good with the bad. And I was like, I mean, the thing is, it's just branding and fame. Like, when you start to have fame, you understand that fame is just a tool. In and of itself, it does nothing. You know what I'm saying? But you can use it, if you know how to use it, you can use it to open up doors, to leverage something on deals, to meet new people, like, and you can start to create platforms and do things with that, right? To be known for something and be limited by it is on you, really. It's just my relationship. I've had a relationship with fame since I was 15. Like, for more, I've been like Rufio more in my life than I haven't been Rufio. Which is crazy, right? But it's just how you look at it and how you are able to use it. It's all a tool, and then you can't put a lot. You know, when I talk to young artists and young creatives and just young people, it's kind of like you say, "What's everything and nothing at the same time?" It's everything and nothing at the same time, and everyone's in it now because we're all on social media and we're all kind of a part of the fame game. This whole fame game thing used to be really just for a very small sect of society, and now it's for like everybody. And so we're dealing with it now, and it's kind of been hard, right? I talk to kids bullied or whatnot, right? And all these things are going on. It's really horrible things are going on. And I've been, my own relationship with being online and having that much engagement with a fan base, you know, whether it be tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, and being able to respond. I mean, that's the really magical thing that's happening. When I'm working with these YouTubers that have millions and millions of subscribers and followers, I go, when we talk to brands and I consult for brands, I go, the magic is these kids, like, you know, the average, say someone like a Spielberg or someone, Scorsese would do a movie, right? Up till now, they'd probably read, who knows, 10 reviews across the country, maybe, of like the best, you know, the big cities, a few reviewers about their film to see how it's landing. The YouTubers will get 10,000 plus reviews, comments a day. So the way they know their audience is so intimate that they know the heartbeat of their audience, and they're never in the history of entertainment have, or in the world, like Coca-Cola, McDonald's, no one has had that much information and that intimate with their audience base, right? Which is really, really powerful. But then the other flip side of that is a lot of kids we work with that as YouTube stars are very scared to stray from that because they go, this audience made me, and they know them so well that they're afraid to do something that they feel that's gonna be backlashed upon because they're gonna feel it, you know? But that's the courage of the artist. You know, I go, well, that's the courage of the artist is to create and to really lead what you're trying to do. All, a lot of the kids that are getting bullied online, I talk to some of the kids, I go, well, this is the deal. Like, as an actor, we get bad reviews, right? But you gotta know that you're not as bad as anyone ever says you are. You're just not. You're really never gonna be as bad as anyone says you are online or a bad review or anything like that. But consequently, you're not as good as anyone says you are either. You're really not that good either. Like, you're putting too much stock in the bad stuff because you're actually putting too much stock in the likes. Like, that stuff doesn't really matter either. It matters because it matters when we're doing business and we're trying to get more money for a project and we have all these eyeballs and all this kind of positivity, but for the actual art and actually who you are, none of, that's why it means everything in one direction and it means nothing in the other direction. That's where we all have to kind of get to. And that's what you try to get to as artists. So you're not really being limited by what people see you as because they don't really know you. You know what I'm saying? And they don't know, really know who your art is. They know what's out there. But also you can use what they know you as a leveraging point or as your fame to kind of get the things done that you want to get done. So it's a balance. It's a juggling act that we have to do as, that we've had to do as artists for years, but now everyone kind of has to do because that's the society we live in right now.
Finance your passions with your typecast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Questions? Questions?
Some backups.
Yeah.
Favorite episode of Avatar? I mean, it's easy to say like the finale ones because it's just so awesome with the fights and the Azula, Zuko, kind of like Agni Kai at the end. There's a bunch of cool, I mean, the like Tales of Bossing, Boss, was it the Tales of Boss?
Bossing
amazing. I watched that again recently and each segment is great. I love the Zuko segment when he's just like a teenager going on a date. Like, yeah. I mean, he could do stuff with the fire and the fountain. That's cool. But also just to see him as like a, just a teenager on a date is beautiful. And then, of course, the Mako one is super emotional. It's hard for me to watch still because it's just, it was actually around the time that he passed away. And so it's super, super emotional. Someone stole a child.
Always alarm your children.
Yeah.
Question?
I have sort of two things. So the first one is I heard that your niece was cast as Cassandra Cain for the New Birds of Prey.
Yeah.
And I was not told, I was forced to ask you to tell her congratulations.
I will. I will. I mean, But I'm a Cheerleader, amazing film. I'm super proud to be a part of that film. It was kind of, you know, it was like in the 90s. It was like not, it was just 90s indie filmmaking. And all indie filmmaking back then was like kind of a newer idea to make movies outside of the studio system. And it was my first time I went to the Sundance Film Festival. And that was probably, I don't know, 15 plus years ago. And it was not the, I mean, it was not the infancy of Sundance, but it was really the beginning of Sundance, and what Sundance was then is definitely different than what Sundance is now. It's grown into this, like, really, it's still awesome, but to go over the years and see it grow into what it's become is pretty amazing. But to be in a gay film at those days was really, it was kind of risque, of course, but also it's really cool because it's like, a generation, if you look back at that film, you see like a generation of young, our generation of young Hollywood. And it was super cool. I was very proud to be in it back then. And part of me being in it was that the director, Jamie Babbitt, you know, originally the character's Dolph is like supposed to be, and we talked about this in my panel last night, is like he's supposed to be like this quarterback of the football team and like this big, tall, blonde dude. He's the guy who plays my love interest in the movie was actually probably should have played Dolph. I don't know how this happened, but she wanted me to play Dolph because she was like, it's ultimately an all-American character. He's like the all-American boy next door, and like Dante, like you're the boy next door. And she understood that essence of me beyond like the physical, you know what I'm saying? So on that alone, I was like, I gotta work with this director. Like, brilliant, I'm down. And so just being on that ride and doing that film was really, really cool. And then being a part of a whole generation, even new generations to come of predominantly like teenagers coming out with their parents and having that film be a part of that process, something I'm incredibly proud of. And and then my niece coming, getting booked as Cassandra Cain and, you know, ultimately gonna be the next Batgirl, which is crazy. But awesome, and it's so exciting because it's like the next generation of Boscos in Hollywood. And me and my brothers and my sister were the first generation coming 30 plus years ago. And we've all worked. I come from a siblings of five of us, and we're all actors and writers and poets and musicians. And you know, we got recognized by the mayor of Los Angeles like on our 30th year anniversary in Hollywood, and as the first Asian American entertainment family, which was very, my parents were very proud of, and it was cool. And then to see all my nieces and nephews all working now, and they're all, you know, do commercials and TV shows and whatnot. And then my niece books and my goddaughter, which I'm proud to my goddaughter also, she's booked this big film, and it's kind of like just like the second generation of Boscos in Hollywood, which is really cool. And I guess when she booked the role, when she was doing the meetings, when she met Margot Robbie was like a big Rufio fan, which is crazy. She's like, Rufio's your uncle? Like, what? And so it kind of all makes sense in some weird way, maybe, hopefully. So I'm excited to see what goes on.
Has fear or anxiety ever interfered with the creative process for you, and how have you dealt with that?
Yeah, I mean, not necessarily. I was talking to some of the girls, Misha, last night, and Hannah, about, I had anxiety. I had like an anxiety attack one time. Doesn't interfere that often, but I did when I first started producing. I was anxious because I was doing a film. I co-wrote a film with this guy named Kev Jumba. We're shooting this movie in Hawaii. And this is a lower budget film, but I talked all these people into doing this film. I co-wrote the film. And then the night before, we're all, a cast of like 10 people, flying to Hawaii to shoot this movie with the whole cast and crew in Hawaii. I got pretty anxious. Because, you know, you just get scared because you're like, I don't know if this is going to work. Like, I just had these ideas. And I talked all these people into doing something, and I didn't know if I could really deliver on what I said we could deliver on. We ended up delivering it, and then sold the film to Mar Vista, and it came out good. But that came in. I don't get too much fear and anxiety. I mean, the whole thing about being an artist is anxious and fear. But it's like, that's the lifestyle of the life that we lead. The reality is, you may not necessarily know where your next check comes from, and you may not even know how good you are. You know what I'm saying? In comparison to the world. But you have to just have this like real either confidence or just blind faith that that you're gonna be able to do it. I mean, the thing about it is that, like, a lot of us, by the time you get to LA, you've had a whole, even though you haven't maybe got paid for it yet, you've done your whole life as a creative, whether you've been like drawing pictures your whole life, or you've been in plays and theater, shooting videos or writing sketches with your friends. But you know, you're, by the time you get to LA, you kind of start having a feeling of like what you're doing, and then you're gonna go from another level on top of that. But as far as fear and anxiety goes, I mean, you know, this lifestyle is not for everybody. But the first hurdle is like getting to LA. You know what I'm saying? Like jumping into, like, I'm gonna actually do this with my life. I may be broke and poor for a amount of time. You may not even make it, you know what I'm saying? But the adventure is worth it. Like I said, I feel like you can't be so detached to, because we don't, ultimately you just don't know what's gonna happen. But fear and anxiety is just like a, it's just like another consideration that you don't, you know, sometimes you don't have to have. It's hard to overcome, but it's like, I don't know. There's been days that we have been broke, me and my friends and my crew. Growing up, you're just broke. You just don't have any money. And you don't know if you're gonna ever have money again, and you don't know. But you do know, you know, we thought we were really good. But then you know, as you get older and you kind of look back at those days, those are like, it's actually some of the most fun days, you know? You have all these other problems now. Like, there's a lot of other problems now. Those days was just like, I don't know. It just sounds like an old man. I don't think. But the short answer is yes, there's fear and anxiety, but no one cares. No one cares. You just kind of go forward and just, you know, you just keep thinking you know what you're doing. Questions?
I have something actually.
Yes.
Before we run out of time, I want to, I talked about with Dante that I thought might be fun for you guys. I printed out a script from a scene from the movie The Iron Giant. And I thought it would be really fun if Dante and myself could read this part of the script. I'll use one of my prospective characters who is Dante's Dante. I do a thing on YouTube. I thought you guys could get a kick out of it. This is the scene where Mansley calls the general on Hogarth's house phone and tries to explain to him what happened.
Okay.
You want to? They're like, whoops. Wrong one.
Oh, my lines are highlighted also.
Yeah, listen, man, I wanted this to go as smoothly as possible for you.
Which is great. I appreciate that.
No problem.
I'm just going to cold read it?
Listen, want to
we'll cold read it.
Take a second for it?
We'll just cold read it.
Would you mind
that?
Hey, cold reading's
like
a
good
skill.
Thank you so much.
Do you have to set it up in any way? You already set it up.
Yeah, I mean, basically, I mean, like...
Who's Vin Diesel? You're Vin Diesel?
Vin Diesel, I'm not...
Nobody's Vin Diesel.
I'm gonna read character that I play called Ludwig, who is an overlord of a secret society of creatures, and you'll.
I'm gonna play it as pick the voice. I don't know.
Zuko.
Zuko's good. Yeah. They're all the same voice. Don't tell anybody. It's all the same voice.
The tagline's gonna hold of this.
It's Dante. Where is Dante? What part of the magical world is Dante in? That's where.
The world is you, is the plot twist. You ready to go?
Good. Awesome. If I mess up, my apologies.
Listen, if I mess up, I apologize.
Damn it, Mansley, you called me at home for this.
You don't understand, sir. It ate my car.
And you saw this happen?
What, no, I didn't actually see it. It went off into the woods and then...
So you
and then
don't
I...
have any evidence?
But, sir, I've got an eyewitness.
An eyewitness with a concussion.
This thing is a menace. It tore up the power station. It caused a train wreck.
What did? Tell me again, Mansley, and this time, listen to yourself.
A giant metal monster. Please, sir, I've got a feeling about this one.
That's lovely, Kent, but let me try and explain to you how this works. If you told me you found, say, a giant footprint, I might send over an expert to make a plaster cast of it. You get me a photograph of this thing, I could probably get some troops over there. But you tell me you have a feeling.
All right then, fine. You want evidence? I'll get you evidence. And when I do, I'm going to want a memo distributed. I want the memo carbon copied and redistributed and...
That sounds swell, Mansley.
Dan,
I think we have time for a few more questions.
Questions? Any questions? Yes.
This question is for Dante as well as other members of the panel.
Yeah.
Were, so how much interaction is there between the sort of professional Hollywood community and the indie or independent community? In film movies.
I met Dante Bosco once.
Cool.
I helped to host a panel, kind of.
There you go.
Yeah.
I mean, it's all mixed up. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think it's all mixed up. It depends, like how. There's different like levels of indie now. Like this weekend's the Oscars, right? And Sunday night, Saturday night is the Spirit Awards, which is the Indie Awards. But that's just like Oscar light. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same people at both parties, basically. But. I mean, there are other indie guys that, like, there's an indie scene in every city in America now. Mm-hmm. Like, when I travel around, whether it be, like, Austin, of course, New York's always an indie scene. I mean, Denver, Portland, there's people making movies everywhere. And they're cool. And there's, like, cool festivals to be part of, and people are doing really cool things, and people are getting audiences in the areas they're from, right? I always tell young artists now, like, the world's changed. You can do it right now from where you're from. Mm-hmm. And by the time you get to LA, you're not coming alone. Like all the artists have come before, since the beginning of time to LA. Now you're coming 10,000 followers, 100,000 followers, a million deep. Like, that's how people are coming to LA now. And that's the leverage or the fame that's opening the doors and helping them get agents and managers and meetings at studios or pitch meetings. And then collaborating with other artists is really great because now we're able to collaborate with a lot of different people. And people are hitting you up from like, hey, I'm from Seattle, I got this script, check out these other things I've done online, if it's something you like, I'd love to, you to come out and shoot this thing for us. And these kind of things are happening that would have never happened in the past. In the past, it'd be like, and I was around, like, so I'm from the last generation that we still were the traditional media where it's like, someone sends you a script that goes to your agents and your managers, and then you like, actually are never gonna see them, ever. Like, it's so sad. And now it's like, you're in the mode, and the possibilities are different, right? You could be a big movie star and meet some like young kid who's like a big influencer and wind up doing a sketch on his Instagram just because you liked each other, and why not? And that's kind of cool. I mean, that's as indie as it gets now. I mean,
I've seen a lot of that.
Yeah, there's some cats that are like, you know, whatever, like, there's a lot of things people talk trash about certain influencers, but some of them really know how to tell a story in a very small amount of time. I mean, the whole Vine thing that happened, I work with a lot of Vine guys that transferred all over to Instagram now, and guys that are, I was like, wow, in what was it, 3 seconds? How many seconds was it?
7 seconds.
6 seconds, there was people telling stories in 6 seconds.
Yeah.
And it was crazy. And some of these guys are like, it really blew my mind, right? When I wrote my first film, on this real indie stuff, and I wrote with Kev Jumba, and Kev's like, this is like 8-9 years ago, and we're writing this film together, and we don't even know what's going on, and with the whole digital media, and I'm like, so what's going on? Like, how does money, how does it work? How do you guys get paid in YouTube? I'm like, what's going on, right? And Kev's like, well, he's like 20, 21. He's like, well, I got like 3.5 million subscribers. I'm like, okay, it's a lot. And he goes, well, I don't, you know, like Ryan, my friend Ryan Higa, he has like 4 million subscribers. I'm like, okay. And I think Ryan has like 20 now or something crazy.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, Ryan makes on average like $100,000. And I go, well, that's good. And he's like, a month. And I was writing and I was like, what? I looked at my other writing partner like, what are we doing? Like, the world has changed. Not that everything's about money, but the idea of how things are scaling and what's the possibilities. And this is, like, it's changed. Like, people aren't really looking at the actual clues of what is going on. And it's happening. Like, Moonlight won the Oscar, right? And I go, okay, Moonlight won the Oscar. And people really, like, focused on the African-American part of it. But, like, what they didn't really see is it's an indie film. This film was like a $1 million film when they first produced it or whatever. And we all do these $1 million films. And no one ever thought that any of these $1 million films, $1-2 million films, would ever win an Oscar. And now it won the Oscar for Best Film of the Year. That's what the digital scene is like, is how it's infiltrating the studio system. That same year, Chance the Rapper won a Grammy for an album that never got released, never got printed to a CD or no label ever picked it up. He just released it on SoundCloud and Spotify, and it won the Grammy. And so what's happening is there's always going to be the studio system. It's always going to be these, you know, the big powers that be, but there's been a big, they don't own the keys anymore to the system. Like, the reality is you guys can make a movie and it can go viral. And it's just going to have as much impact as anything we do. You know what I'm saying? And so that's how the indie market is happening. Like, the indie is like, it's real indie. Like, it's a 13-year-old kid on an iPhone is going to make something that is going to be, that's going to be more impactful than half the Hollywood pictures that came out last year. You know what I'm saying? And so we all are like, who's good? Who's good? That's what it comes down to. Like, who's actually really good? Because we want to work with that person.
Yeah, you see that with a lot of actors now. There was a indie film called Scrapper that has someone from Game of Thrones. It was like, hey, I want to work with you, but I have to keep my hair the same for Game of Thrones. Is that all right? He was like, yeah. He was like, okay. He just flew out.
Yeah.
Filmed with them.
Yeah, yeah. So a lot of that's happening. So there is a way for people to kind of like go back and forth. I mean, it depends on the artist, but it's all happening. Questions? Questions?
Nope, there's one back there.
First of all, I want to say thank you for being here today, but I wanted to hear your perspective as an Asian American actor in this industry about ethnicity-specific casting. For example, Anna Taylor's taken away from auditioning for live action work because she's Japanese, or you know, Monica Hunter got casted in a film as a book for which I love, but she's Vietnamese and not Korean, so I guess I wanted to hear your perspective about that.
Yeah, she asked about, if you guys didn't hear, like my perspective on casting in Hollywood, and specifically within the Asian realm. It's really a weird thing, right? Because I think it's great that we're getting to a place where we're trying to cast consciously and really responsibly, to a degree, right? But at the same token, you know, I'm Filipino, so. If I had to wait for like a Filipino role to come up in Hollywood, I would like have no career. And so there's like two edges of the same sword. And consequently, there's like, they're not casting that way in the white world. You know what I'm saying? There's like all these cats in the white world that are playing whatever. They're not necessarily Italian or Jewish or any of it. You know what I'm saying? So I think it's really a project by project thing that you have to look at and how it's all being kind of put together. There is a, I mean, the pendulum swings, right? So we're like in a pendulum swing right now where everyone's trying to be so, so specific. And I think sometimes it is very important and it does matter. And then sometimes I think it's just, you know, it's about, you know, just making more fuss over things that may not be as important to the project, depending on, you know, if it's a historical project and you're casting it all a certain way, sure. If it's like, I mean, how specific are we going, you know? And as we're going into like this new America, we're all so mixed, and so, I mean, what happens to mixed people? You know, like they can only play mixed characters. Like, so there's all these kind of crazy things that are happening, but I think we, the good thing is that we are being conscious of it, and we are asking questions, and we have to continue to ask questions, and no, we're not always going to be right, obviously, but I think we're in the right direction of moving there and being able to ask those questions. I think that's why I'm coming on some projects to consult for certain things, and I'm dealing with the problems too, like, okay, like, how Korean are we going? North, you know, which part of China are we talking about? Like, that, all that kind of stuff. But it matters sometimes, and sometimes it doesn't matter. And also, you know, you want a good actor. That's the other wild card, right? You may think it's one thing, but then all of a sudden, someone comes in, and you're like, that person is definitively better than everyone else. And you're like, well, what do we do with that? Maybe they don't fit exactly in. And then you gotta, everything matters for something, you know? It's fascinating. I don't know, my niece just booked Cassandra Cain, and they wanted her to be Asian. She's half Korean and half Filipino. And I'm like, okay, what is she, you know? And so I think it matters and it's important. And at the same time, you know, sometimes it doesn't really matter because it's all make-believe anyway. You know, it's like, so you balance, like, how do we do this? But the reality is we need more of our faces out there in a very conscious way for us to balance it out before we can really, you know, assess it. Because that's the problem with a lot of it, is that there is only one thing. And that's, again, that's the part of the problem. You know, we talk about a friend of mine, Getty Watanabe, who was in a film called 16 Candles, and he played Long Duk Dong. And that character is thought to be like very, and it's very stereotypical, and a lot of issues with that character. Also, that character is one of the classic characters in the 80s of all movies of all time in the 80s. Like, one of the most memorable characters, Long Duk Dong, right? And Getty's a brilliant actor. But because there was no other Asian characters at that time, that was the only memorable Asian character almost in the whole 80s, that's the problem. If there was like 6, 10, 12 other characters, then you can really see and appreciate the magic of what he did with that character. I mean, years later, someone like a Ken Jeong could do something in, you know, The Hangover, which has similar stereotypes that he's dealing with, but also does a brilliant performance and is celebrated in a different way than that. But also it's in a time where we have a lot more different faces and different characters that we can kind of balance it off of. So I don't know if I really answered your question specifically, you know, but I think that being in the conversation and having more faces out there, period, is going to help kind of figure it out. There's no really right answer to it.
Well, it is 3 o'clock, and I think that was a good answer to end on. So thank you for being here.
Thank you, guys.